On to the Student Affairs Committee, and just to be clear, the members of that committee, everyone's here. Linda Ball, George Nichols, Melissa Dennison, our student rep Cole, and the chair, Thomas.
Thank you, Chair Bell. We have one information item on the agenda for Student Affairs this morning, and that is a student presentation, and I'm going to ask Dr. Lupin to introduce that presentation.
Bring it a minute, just one moment.
It's really nice to have faculty and students part of our meetings. Welcome. Nothing to be afraid of. Maybe Halloween.
Thank you, Regent Thomas, and thank you to the board for this opportunity to highlight some of our students in this particular student organization, OLAS, who is going to be telling you a little bit about their programs and their experiences today. We're coming right off the end of Hispanic Cultural Heritage Month, September 15th through October 15th, which is a wonderfully placed recognition and cultural observation, since it is butted up against the historic 16 de septiembre, the Grito of Independence in Mexico. And so there is the reason why we have that 15th to the 15th to the 1st. So this is the OLAS group, and I have some wonderful representatives here today that I'd love to introduce to you. Abner Rubio from right here from Bowling Green, who's a senior nursing major and the vice president of OLAS. Emily Ten Torres, who is from the Dominican Republic, junior majoring in international business and Spanish, and she's the membership coordinator for OLAS, and Jenny Tovar from Nashville, Tennessee, who's a senior majoring in political science and international affairs, public relations officer for OLAS, and social media marketing intern and navigator for our one and only ISEC. So these students represent this organization, the Hilltopper Organization of Latin American Students, and I'd love for them to tell you a little bit about their organization.
So hello, everybody. First of all, we want to thank you guys. Thank you to the board for allowing us to be here today and presenting. Thank you to Dr. Logan for helping us out. So we are OLAS, the Hilltopper Organization of Latin American Students. We recently just took this picture outside with our little flags representing our colleges with some of our members. Yes, so OLAS. We were established in 2011. We were established to promote the needs of Latin American students here on Western's campus. We took a brief hiatus. We came back in 2012, and we just recently celebrated our 10-year anniversary. As you can see here, we had original members come, original exec members come, the very first who started this organization. We also had the opportunity to send off some of our seniors who just graduated. It was a very fun, important event for all of us because we got to see the alumni who are now professionals in their field, ranging from engineers to dental hygienists, people in business. And so it really motivated us, current members, to see how they've excelled in their fields. So here in OLAS, we strive to create a positive experience for all Latin American students here on WQU's campus through educational and social support. For example, you know, throughout the semester we host various study sessions. We hold workshops, organizational workshops, time management, how to use a planner, things like that. We also have various guest speakers. We have our meetings on Mondays at DSU, and we have various guest speakers come. As you can see in the second picture over here, one of our very own members was presenting to us on the field of school psychology. She's a graduate student and an OLAS member. So, like I said, various guest speakers come and talk to us about different educational opportunities, different career options. And we're happy for them that they come to our meetings and allow the members to see what's out there beyond college.
It's a delight switch, I'm sorry.
So while we are all university students, we are students first, but we also believe that it is also important to have some type of social support in order to be able to keep students here and want to keep continuing their college education. And so we do provide a lot of social events. These are some of the events that we had for this year's Hispanic Heritage Month. We had All Around the World, which was very, very popular. We basically had foods from all over Latin America. We had foods from Colombia, Venezuela, Mexico, just all around. We also had a very fun Loteria night, which is kind of like bingo. Also one of my favorites. And then we have other like field day. We have Olaf Giving. It's just a nice way to have our members know that we are here to support you, not only in school, but in a social aspect too. These are also some more of our events. We had our Carne Asada, which is a cookout. We had a lot of members really enjoy that event. And then we also cleaned up the basketball stadium. That was a nice way just to make quick money. And then also just bond while we were cleaning up. It was just really, really fun, actually.
Okay, so OLAS has participated in many community service activities inside and outside of campus. And here we can see three examples of what we have done in the community. On the far right, we see one of our members, Julio, on the Humane Society. We go there to help the staff members walk the dogs, play with the cats, and it's to give the animals a good experience, to let them know they are not forgotten, but they're gonna get out of there at some point, to feel the human touch. Another service that we do is Dueña de mi futuro, owner of my future. That's a program for Latino girls from grade 6 to 12, so they can learn more about future college careers. It is hosted here on campus, and our members participating there as group leaders, facilitating the activities when people go to talk with them and to create social events for the girls while they go to every of the activities in the meantime. And the last one is Feeding America. We've helped Feeding America for many years now. We mainly help when they have food for the Hispanic community. And our members have helped setting up where the food is gonna be for the car, preparing the bags of the people, giving it to them. We have done it in the cold, in the rain, when it's hot. It doesn't matter for us. What we want to do is help our own community and help everyone else that is here on Kentucky. And that's pretty much it.
Yes. Once again, thank you very much for having us here, for giving us the chance to briefly talk about OLAS. It's an organization that's very important to all of us. We came here to Western's campus and we found this community, this family. I feel like all of us, we gravitate towards people who have common interests as us, and we found it in this organization, and we consider all of us a huge family. As mentioned before, we have educational support services here, we have social services, and we've created just one big family here. And, you know, that's why we're exec members. We want to lead, we want to show the members, give members the experience. So thank you again for having us here.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions or comments for the students or going back to London?
The one thing I'm struck by, I guess I was expecting to see a lot more students. And so my question would be, what should we be doing to attract more students?
I think there are a lot of us. It's just we don't always get together, like all of us, like at the same time, just because our class schedules change every semester. Some of them have late night classes. Our meetings are at 6 p.m. So some of this, some of our members actually don't have time. I think we have, I think like 90 registered members. Not, it's like 90 something registered members. We just, they just don't all make it to meetings.
We have Regent Nichols with us, who founded the ISEC. We have Martha Sales with us, and I wonder if you all have any comments.
I'm just really proud of the student organization. They also are leaders in the Intercultural Student Engagement Center. They assist us with our intercultural student engagement graduation celebration. With that is increased as well. So they have been able, and you all didn't mention you were able to study abroad through some funding from CJ and George and Intercultural Student Engagement Center. So they are doing awesome things. I'm very proud of them.
I guess from my perspective, I think so highly of what Dr. Sales has been able to put in place, but I was aware that when we think about ISEC, and I think most of us think of it, it really is probably dominant for African-American students, that she's done a great job expanding that and bringing in a Latino population with us. So pretty excited that we can do more, because what I just heard is exactly what CJ and I envisioned in the beginning, was how do we create the social support, which is so important, because there's so many other programs that we're not academic support that you can still incorporate that in, but feeling that belonging is really important to us. So it's great to hear from the students.
And to pick up on Chair Bale's comment, what we've managed to do during the past 5 years is essentially double the number of Latin American studying students on our campus. We know this is the fastest growing demographic in the nation. We know in our region they're an important part of our community, and certainly in Nashville as well. And so what we want to ensure we're doing that as we grow those students participating as Hilltoppers, we want to make sure that they find their people, wherever they are. And so we are ever more diverse, with over 21% now students of color in the undergraduate population. And for us to be successful, we got to make sure that everybody has the supports they need, not just to get here, but to get through and leave with a degree. And so congratulations on the great growth in the organization. Francisco Serrano was one of the folks that I first met when I was here, and was a leader on campus. And I was so thankful for the guidance that Francisco gave to me when I arrived as president. And we've continued to help really grow the organization, and you all should be very proud of the work. So congratulations.
Double it again. Triple, quadruple.
Thank you so much for being here. You're thanking us for allowing you to be here. We can't tell you how much we appreciate you being here this morning. It's good for us to be able to hear from you.
Thanks to these students and to their faculty advisor, Fabian Alvarez, who has done some great work supporting that group. This is the epitome of what a student organization should be. It's both educational, it's supportive, it's social, and it is a great way to spend time together. And so it's a wonderful organization in our student organization cadre, and it's great to have had the opportunity to work with these students to bring them here today. So thank you. Thank you.
I think it's always good to have our that we can't, because after all, that is our focus. And Dr. Tavonia, I certainly agree with you on the faculty as well. It was very interesting. Hopefully, do continue.
Absolutely.
Sure, that concludes my.
Well said. Thank you, Chair Thomas. Does anybody need a break?
You did have a call.
Okay. Well, plow on then and go to the executive committee, whose members are with us today. Our first item on it has to do with the athletic employment contract for our head women's basketball coach. with us today. And Todd?
Yes, sir. Thank you. I can actually address both of these at the same time if the board is okay with this. You know, as we've discussed before, when you go into the final year of a contract, that's not an overall healthy situation. It creates a lame duck status and makes it more difficult to do your job. And I think specifically the coaching is used against them in recruiting. So in both these instances, these two would be going into the final year of their contract. We all pay attention to everything going on in college athletics. It's an arms race in a lot of respects. There's some crazy things going on. Certainly some things that we would never do, you know, that nor should we ever do. But that being said, I do think that when you have really good people who are doing a good job, you need to acknowledge that. And what these two addendums do with these two is it's largely an extension of their existing contract under the current terms with a few minor tweaks that take care of them and reward them for success moving forward, such as conference championships. They both feel very good about it. And if you were to approve this, it positions each of them very well for success as we move forward.
Good. Questions, comments? Andrea, are we okay putting both these items together?
Yes.
Anybody have an objection to doing that? If there are no comments, we'll entertain a motion for approval of committee item 1 and 2, the head women's and men's basketball.
So moved.
Have a motion.
Second
from Regent West. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Thank you very much, Todd.
Mr. Chair, before we proceed, there's some people on this end of the table who would like to take a break before we listen.
Well, this would be a good time. So, how about we see? It is 10 o'clock on the nose. 8 minutes. 10:08. Gavel drops.
Chair Bale, I'm pleased to report that Conference USA is in good shape. For those of you who recall last year at about this time, we have received word as a conference that there were 6 teams departing to the American Conference. And in the few weeks after that, there were 3 schools that departed to the Sun Belt, which left Conference USA with 5 schools. You need 6 for an automatic qualifier. And really more than that to be a viable conference. When that happened, I was appointed chair because I was vice chair, and we worked hard to secure 4 additional members of Conference USA. And so you will recall we added New Mexico State, Sam Houston State University, Jacksonville State University, which is in Alabama, not Florida, and Liberty University to get us to 9. And then there were some schools that expressed an interest in joining Conference USA. The conference also has a list of schools that we are interested in pursuing. And so once we got to 9, we said we would pause and do some work quietly behind the scenes to grow the conference if we thought that was a good idea. There was also always a possibility that we could stay at 9. In the process of media conversations with potential media partners, it became pretty clear that 10 was where we should go. And so we had heard from some institutions, and you may hear some of this in the local media, or if you pay attention to social media or any of the athletics chat boards. There was an in-state institution that was interested in EKU, and I was I think the conference was thankful for their interest. But we had other institutions that we were talking with as well. And last week, Kennesaw State received approval from the Georgia Regents to join Conference USA. And some folks have asked me, either in a public way or privately, why it is Kennesaw State was the choice and not EKU. And as much as I appreciate what our good colleagues in Richmond are doing, the Kennesaw State is a terrific addition because they are in a fast-growing area and of the country, just outside of Metro Atlanta. They have 40,000 students, so an institution of great strength in terms of their student demographics. Number three, their athletics budget already puts them in the middle of the pack of Conference USA. And so there really was no other institution that was on the conference's list of potential additions that brought that kind of institutional strength, commitment to athletics, and we were very pleased to add them just last week. And so we are at 10 schools now. If you asked me what's the likelihood of going to 12, I think that is a possibility. But I think we're comfortable today at 10. The membership committee of the conference will continue to work on potential additions. But we're focused today, or now as a conference, on really finalizing a new media rights agreement. And what we've heard, and what our athletic director has heard from our fans, is we want a simpler way to find games, and we would prefer to have more TV exposure on linear channels. And so I think what you're going to see in the coming weeks as we finalize the agreement with our media partners is hopefully more linear exposure for the conference and for our teams. I think you're going to see a simplified way to find our games. And you're going to see an increase in exposure, an increase in coverage, and also an increase in the platform. So more news to come in the weeks ahead, but pleased for us that we are in a conference that is stable, that is bringing in teams that have a record of success athletically, and will add additional stability to the work that we're doing. You can imagine if we were to go to 12, that would create an opportunity probably for divisions, so 6 schools in the east, 6 schools in the west, instead of playing just as a single division as we're doing now. But very pleased that we're at this point. It has taken a tremendous amount of work on the part of the conference staff, the executive committee, the membership committee, but pleased with the work that they've all done to get us to this place. And so for those of you at this time last year who were concerned about our conference affiliation, I would say the best is yet to come.
Mr. President, comments? Todd, you want to take a minute to crow a little bit about our performance in Conference USA?
Actually, what I'm going to crow about, and I've said this publicly, so it's not the first time I've said it, but as the chair of the Conference USA Executive Committee, when everything hit the fan, so to speak, last fall, He was not the chair. He was not the president. And the president of North Texas was. And then they left the league, and he left his chairmanship. And then President Caboni, essentially, to use a sports analogy, it was the equivalent of somebody saying, hey, the bases are loaded. There's nobody out. There's 3 balls and no strikes on the batter. Can you come in now and pitch and get us out of this inning? That's really what he got asked to do. And so his report just illustrated everything that's happened in the last year. But this conference was very fortunate that he was on deck to be the chair, because if that was not the case, I think we would be having a very different conversation today. I truly believe that. But where we are today is good. I mean, I think the conference is in much better shape today than it was a year ago. There are people that want to be in the league. You know, it's not a dying league. It's a league that people see as an opportunity. Really what we have to do, I think from a competitive standpoint, our league will be good, than maybe better than what some people think. The newness of the schools, it's incumbent upon all of us to educate our fans about the schools that are coming in, because because our fans won't be familiar with them, but they will be successful. With us, our goals don't change. I mean, we've dominated Conference USA since we've been in it, and we don't plan on that changing at all. Our goals don't change, but I do think there is reason for excitement and optimism moving forward.
I think we've won more championships than anybody in Conference USA, and I think it's worth pointing out that those that bolted for the American Conference, that was driven by media, and they were all from large metropolitan areas.
Right, that was their strategy. We've won 36 conference championships since we entered Conference USA. The next closest school has won 28. And what's really nice about that is 12 different sport programs have participated in that. So it's been an across-the-board success. It really is pretty unique, and I think it just speaks to our coaches and our athletes and what they've been able to achieve.
Okay. Any comments? Okay. Thank you. Thank you. All right. We have with us Dr. Buddy Steen from our Innovation Campus. Buddy, welcome. We will put you on the stage, President Monday.
Just a couple of introductory comments. Those of you who recall at my investiture, which is ever longer ago these days, I guess 4.5 years ago, we announced four important initiatives, two of which are complete-ish, the Commons at Helm Library, the First Year Village. We continue to work on the Opportunity Fund. And the fourth was the creation of a true innovation campus for our university. And we had the great good fortune of Buddy Steen returning to the university. And in the past year and a half, he has done some tremendous work at building partnerships, elevating the visibility of the campus, and really transforming it into what we all aspire for it to be. And that's a hub that attracts people to Bowling Green, that supports innovation and entrepreneurship, and really creates a place here in Bowling Green that's the connective tissue between the major markets of Nashville and Louisville, but does it in a way that's good for South Central Kentucky's economy. So Buddy's leadership has been outstanding, and I'm glad for you to hear all the different things that he's been able to accomplish with his team in the past year or so.
Well, before I start, I really want to say how thankful we are to you. You're the founder of the Innovation Campus. You know, that allows us to do these fun, wonderful things. And thank you all, too, Board of Regents, for your leadership. I mean, leadership is the critical piece that allows these things to happen. Without it, it's over. Susan, my boss, Susan Howard, the whole SOF team. No joke, that's super important. So let's do real quickly, just kind of remind everybody, Innovation Campus, kind of why, and then how we'll update recent house. Of course, everything's WKU branded. CREATE is a group that we formed. It's a 501c3. It's the Economic Development Core. These guys, when we put our hats on CREATE, we're thinking about central region ecosystem for arts, technology, and entrepreneurship. And that's kind of a serious combination of things, okay? We'll get to that a little bit later. Kentucky Innovation, which is a cabinet for economic development group, they fund the CREATE group for more of kind of an entrepreneurial ecosystem development. So we get funding there. The Bowling Green Area Chamber of Commerce is a full partner. The Center for Research and Development, this is the building, right, that sits on the corner of Nashville Road and Canyon Lane. There's an accelerator in there, which is really, really big program, allocated space where companies can actually start in 300 square feet and continue to grow, and I'll show you a picture about that in a minute. But that sort of physical infrastructure used to start companies in Bowling Green and keep them here so they don't head south. The Research Foundation is really more of the fiscal core of the Innovation Campus, and that's a whole bunch of people, okay, with Western. If you were to invent something like Rachel did, okay, then that IP, that intellectual property, will ultimately filter down into the Research Foundation, and it's our responsibility to either spin off a company, which we really like to do, like Rachel's doing, starting our own company and license that tech, or license it out and create revenues. ARTP is the Applied Research and Technology Program at Western, and that's pretty much all of the tech at the university. 95% of all of the equipment and applied tech is through that ARTP program, and there's one missing
icon. I was talking to Dr. Terrence Brown earlier on here. We haven't created one yet, but there is an intimate relationship between the Potter College and the application of that Potter College talent in the Innovation Campus. And I'll tell you one that's important in just a minute. The magic that makes all of that work is alignment. And I am serious. It is all about that. The ecosystems die from misalignment, and quite frankly, a lot of these entities don't naturally align. So we have to, our responsibility is to make sure that happens, and there is precision alignment right now in Bowling Green. And it's one of the reasons why we are going, continuing to grow in one of the fastest growing cities, and with universities right at the core of all that. But that alignment is fantastic right now. The why? Because you told us to. Okay, this is your strategic plan. Okay, you know, we pay attention. The regional lighthouse, regional provide resources to attract talent, nurture intellectual capital. Those are brilliant concepts and apropos right now for sure. You know, quality of life regionally, we'll talk about that in a minute. Well, actually, the very definition of economic development, the way we see it, is proactive, organized actions locally to increase the overall standard of living, both economically and culturally. And in order to attract talent in this region, it's a kind of a different game now. Like 20 years ago when I did this before, you could have a great company and a job, and the talented folks would take it. Today, you have to have a place where talented people want to be and live, and then, oh, by the way, thank you for a great job. And that's, it sounds funny, but it's really true. So we focus a lot on how do we make Bowling Green and our entire region, ask of all of these places where these talented people want to be. And then we'll also get the companies because of it. And I'll tell you about some programs that we've created that are world scale at the Innovation Campus to do that very thing. Investing in the future, inspiring individuals. This was your all's thing. All of the strategies in the Regional Lighthouse we do every day. And that's what we do every single day. Our mission is kind of the tough one. Transform existing facilities. We have a $50 million facility out there in that old mall is a $50 million old mall. Center for Research and Development. We reinvent programs when we need to, and we want to gather innovative intellectual capital. That's talent. That's the key. So everything really you'll see is kind of centralized on that. And if you do that, it will create meaningful corporate engagement. And corporate, when we say that, that's the highest and hardest. That includes all private sector, all businesses, you know, and startups included. When we do that, we will have university faculty, staff, and students working alongside those businesses. Rachel's a great example of a company that was inspired. You know, we've got a couple of other companies that the WKURF spins off, and that's the Innovation Campus. And those opportunities and jobs are created because of that. So you have to kind of put all that together to create that ecosystem so that you really do have opportunities and jobs for our students, for our alumni to come back, and I'll tell you about a really cool one in a minute about that. Another thing that Dr. Cabani did, not only founding the Innovation Campus, but corporate engagement in a meaningful way could not be more strongly said and done than something that you started. You started with Dr. Kilboney and Mike Beckerton and Logan Aluminum got together, and they said, we want to create kind of a metals cluster. That was a year or so, or maybe two ago. It was a long, kind of a long, thick time coming. But we just launched this thing. These are eight of the biggest metal companies in Kentucky across the entire state have come together. They formed something called a Metals Innovation Initiative. This is a cluster that's headquartered, of course, at the WKU Innovation Campus. And it's essentially the physical manifestation of the Innovation Campus. All of its pillars of existence are pillars of our existence. So we're going to do more of that. So thank you for that. So here's a kind of the map of things. Things have changed. We don't have any more retail. The Big Lots folks are no longer there. But get this. Instead of the Big Lots in there, Holly Inc. just installed their research and development center. They're creating sustainability engineering projects. This is not, they're designing from scratch, and they're working with our students. By the way, students are ubiquitous through everything. I don't even say it because they're involved in everything. They have a sustainability engineering program at Holly, and they approached us to make sure that WKU engineering is plugged into that. And of course, that happens. The rest of the space, I don't really have time to go too much. This accelerator space is in the back. I invite you to come and see this. There's something I wanted to talk about, and that's the collaborative smart space. And that is, this is an initiative that is bringing people from the world into what we're doing. I mean, no kidding. We have a recycling consortium that we're working with Jennifer Jigas, and that's starting to form. That's going to happen. That's in the process. MIT is partnering with WKU and the Potter College. We created an open documentary lab, and get this. The person that was selected as the first fellow was just inducted into the New York Blues Hall of Fame. Not only playing, but writing about it. He's a prolific author. He's a prolific blogger. And if you came to our collaborative smart space, which is in 30,000 square feet of that facility, you could meet him. Very, very interesting fellow. We just formed a workforce innovation lab. Workforce innovation lab is really important, because the programs that we're piloting there are the kind of programs that unlock that talent from the workforces that are already out there. And I'll kind of go through very quickly what may be my most favorite. And this is a confidential living database of talent. This is a collaboration between Potter College, the students, Mark Simpson, which kind of bridges both, Dr. Simpson, myself, Sam Ford. And what we've done is we've created a website where friends and family and folks that know of people that have left the region, alumni that have left the region for meaningful employment, can confidentially communicate their talent and capabilities into that database. When I say confidential, we all have signed NDAs. This one doesn't go on the internet. Okay? When you put your name in that database, when we have opportunities, and maybe we will even create some because of it, we're going to bring them home. So we've had some brain drain going on for 20 years, but that amplifies the impact of that program that we created, and it's all about talent. When Envision, AESC, who's spending $2 billion to build a plant, heard about that database, they became tenants at the Innovation Campus. The number one guy that's building the plant, you could meet him if you went to the collaborative smart space. When Logan Aluminum heard about that database, tenants at the collaborative smart space. They just tripled their occupancy there. So again, this is the meaningful corporate engagement focused on talent. And there's a lot more, but thank you so much.
Comments? George, I know you've got something to say.
I'm just trying to figure out how to invest.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. That's really exciting.
Yeah.
And all the things that you shared are things that I hear and see across the country. So it's great to see that happen right there. That you
Research Triangle 30 or 40 years ago comes to mind, and look what it's done to that. We do have demographics in our favor in this particular thing, because America is moving to the Sun Belt. Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, and North Carolina have trees and water, and we don't have hurricanes.
We may have tornadoes, but we don't want to talk about that. Anyway. Let me add just a bit of a complexity. I'm so thankful that nothing screams Innovation Campus like a Big Lots. I'm kidding. And I remember one of the conversations that I had early in my tenure around that space was, why do we have that? What are we doing? Why is that there? And we needed a revenue stream. Like, well, great, let's create a revenue stream that's not Big Lots, because it just doesn't speak to the mission of the space. And so that symbol of that transition really is a pivot for the entire complex. And we have some work to do, some additional investments to be made to actually make it look like what we aspire for it to look like. And we're going to work on that in the coming couple of years. But for us as an institution,
to do what we want to do on the research side of the house, for us to grow for our portfolio. Last year grew from $14 to $16 million in research. We want to double that in the coming 5 years. And Ron G's probably never. I'm looking over my shoulder, so he's sweating yet. So to go from $16 to $32 million in research is going to require exactly what you heard today. As an applied research institution, we have no aspirations to be an R1, but we do have aspirations for R2 status. And that means work that is applied, that's connected to companies, and that involves students in the research. But also, if you think about the opportunities ahead at the federal level, and Senator McConnell was very helpful in this, the CHIPS Act that was signed in August to help around technology manufacturing. If you dig into that, there is a bucket of money in the tens of billions of dollars that is restricted to emerging research institutions. That's us. And so all of this work positions us to do that, elevates the aspirations of our faculty to be able to go after those investments. And then I think the last thing this does for our institution, it really changes our sights for who we are. We have the infrastructure in place. We're growing the partnerships. There are funds available to us. And as we continue to transform our faculty, the expectation around sponsor research and the support for those who are going to do that is going to be ever, ever more important. So really pleased with this, where we are. You all know we're in the halfway point of our strategic plan, and during the next 5 years, we're going to talk ever more about innovation, research, and sponsored research. Thank you, Bert.
Buddy, your enthusiasm is palpable.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. Okay. It is almost Halloween. I've been assured we don't have any apparitions in this room by Pamela, but she's going to tell us a few places on campus where we need to be wary.
A few.
Pamela served on this board for a number of years. I had the pleasure of serving with her. She was a great staff regent, and it's nice to have her back with us today in a different role.
Well, thank you for having me, and I will say, I'm going to start my timer so I make sure. I know I'm the last thing between you all and freedom for the day. So.
Shaq!
Shaq. And I've chose not to do any PowerPoint or anything because I'm just going to talk. And, you know, as we're gearing up for Nightmare on Normal Street for our homecoming, I'm not sure how familiar everyone is about the ghost stories on campus, because I know I've talked to some people who had a lot of experiences. Some people have worked here for years and go, I never knew this was going on. But given the time, I'm only going to limit it to the three buildings that were featured in the Ghost Hunters episode. I don't know. Yes.
Not my office, right?
I was getting ready to say, I'm purposely going to avoid Craig Administrative Center, which would be on my ghost tour if I was doing a ghost tour. Can I at least talk about
that? Okay, sure.
Because not one, but two presidents died in that building. It was the original.
That's 20% of our presidents.
I'm not sure why, but the third president did move out. But that was the original president's home, so. But we won't get into that one. So the Ghost Hunter show, actually, if you're familiar with that, some of you may have seen it, did come to campus. They focused on three buildings, Van Meter, Potter, and Schneider Hall. Van Meter and Potter and the former Barnes came with probably some of our more well-known ghost stories. But a little bit to go with that, if you've heard of Van Meter, you may have heard about that there was a worker killed during construction. It was built in 1911, and he was on the roof looking for an airplane and fell through the skylight and died. And that's actually not true. There's no documentation on that. However, what actually happened was in 1918, there was a student named Henry Clegg from Alabama who was at the Bowling Green Business University. And he and a group of other students had somehow got on the roof of Van Meter. And they weren't just looking for airplanes. They were looking for the first airplane to fly into Warren County. Lieutenant Bloodworth was flying in from Memphis. He was going to be doing some shows for the Warren County Red Cross Fair. So unfortunately, he was looking up the sky. He did fall through the skylight and was fatally injured. He did not die, though. He died in St. Joseph Hospital. But, you know, in the 1960s, we had a student who was in a play production. They were doing a little bit of a play. He's sitting in the dressing room in Van Meter. He's the last one there. He's taking off his makeup, and he's looking in the mirror, and he sees somebody standing behind him, kind of leaning down with their face close to his shoulder. And he said he was middle-aged, had really stark features, and kind of a blue glow around him. And so he turned around to see who was there. When he turned around, there wasn't anyone. So pretty soon he wasn't there either. But don't be mistaken that these are old stories as well, because in 2017, because these are still going, there was a young man who worked for Aramark, which several of you in here would know if I said the name. And in fact, he used to cater the Board of Regents meetings back in the day. But he was working, they had catered an event for a concert in Van Meter, and everyone had left, and he's gathering up everything, and he's got a cart, and he's going, if you're familiar with Van Meter, the top hallway behind on the second floor, and he's headed towards the elevator, and he looks down, and he sees a man sitting in the auditorium, and he's like, that's weird, nobody's supposed to be here, and he can see him well enough to know it's a man, and he's dressed. He's sort of a different time period. He had a string tie on, an older style clothing. And he thought, well, I guess he's waiting for somebody. So he turns away just for a second. He takes a step or two, and he says, well, maybe I should make sure that he doesn't need any help or something. And so he turns back around, and he's gone. He said, now, where he's standing up there, and the man was sitting in the auditorium, he could see pretty much the whole area, and there was no way for him to have gotten out of that seat and completely out of the building, out of that auditorium, in the 2 or 3 seconds that he had looked away. So he decided it was time for him to go too. He hurriedly left. Potter Hall is another one that's one of our more well-known. It was originally a women's residence hall, and my apologies to those who work in Potter Hall. I can't give everybody a break. And the stories that I'm telling you are stories that I've gotten firsthand. I've been interviewing people. I've interviewed about 80 people so far for research in a book that I'm doing. So they're the firsthand. This isn't something that somebody, you know, an urban legend or somebody said or something. I have the names of these people. I talked to them. They're firsthand what they experienced. So Potter, sadly, there was a young woman who had passed away in 1979, and everyone attributes the haunting's activity to that event. And so when someone was sitting there, a gentleman is working late one night, and he's sitting there, and he hears footsteps. And it sounds like someone walking down the hall towards his office, but the motion sensor lights don't come on, and he doesn't see anybody, but he really feels like somebody's walking up towards him. And he's sitting there, and all of a sudden he hears a voice say, go. And he looks at the clock, and it's 7:56, and apparently she doesn't want you there after 8 o'clock. Until 8 o'clock you're, well, no, that's not true. But after 8 o'clock. And he was braver than most. He said, I'm finishing an email. When I get through, I will leave. And he did. One of my favorite stories from Potter is there was a gentleman who worked here, and he was working really late one night. We have dedicated staff, Dr. Kimono. They work late. and he's telling me that there's no such thing as ghosts. You know, it's fun to talk about in October, especially this time of year with our homecoming and everything, but there's no such thing as ghosts. How can anybody believe in ghosts? And this isn't about whether or not you believe or not. These are just the stories that happen, but absolutely there's no such thing as ghosts. But he worked in Potter, and he said, but there was this one night. And he said, I don't know how to explain it. And he said he'd gone to the restroom, got a drink of water, and he heard footsteps coming down the hall. And of course, the hall kind of has some angles to it. And not just footsteps, but he heard, like, somebody had keys in their pocket, they're jingling their keys. And he's like, he calls out, he says, hey, don't let me scare you, because it's just me and, you know, I'm here working late. No answer. Footsteps get closer, still hears the keys jingling. Hey, it's me, calls out again, no answer. Finally, they're like really close. He's like, don't let me run in, you know, it's me, don't let me scare you. And he goes around the corner and he hears the footsteps go past, and there's nobody there. He did not work that late after that. But again, he absolutely does not believe in ghosts, but he just can't explain how that happened. Personally, I started my career, I worked here for over 25 years, and started as a police officer. And so when I was in showing a young police officer around in the middle of the night during a break in Potter Hall, who was still residence hall, we actually did hear a noise ourselves that we went to investigate, you know, somebody's in a room, what's going on. When we go down the hall, we identify the room, and as I'm getting my keys off my belt, we hear this metallic sound. I'm like, what was that? And he said, I saw that. What was it? And it had the round doorknobs, and the round doorknob, we stood there with the flashlight on it because it's the middle of the night, and the doorknob just moved. And we're like, okay, somebody's in this room. So we throw the key in the door, and we go in. There's nobody there. Windows secure, no breeze, nothing to account for the noises that we've heard coming from the room or the door not moving. Like, yep, time for us to go too. So the last building that I'll talk about, Snyder Hall. It actually is an urban legend. There, if you've not heard the story of Snyder, it was during a break back in the 40s or back in some time or back a long time ago, and two women had stayed behind after the break, and so they're there alone in the building, and they've been warned not to go out. One of them goes out, gets something to eat, she's coming back. Someone had escaped from an insane asylum, and they climbed up the stairwell, the fire escape, and they'd broken in, and they had an axe, and he starts killing her. And she screamed for help, and the other girl's too terrified to open the door. And, of course, this was long before phones in the room, much less cell phones or anything, so she's there until the next morning it gets light and things are quiet, and she opens the door, and she either finds the girl dead with the axe in her head or finds the blood there and she's gone. It varies. That exact story, almost verbatim, is in a book on urban legends. You will find it at every university campus. While we can document several tragic things that happened, that one we cannot. But that doesn't mean that things don't still happen in that building. And I'll circle back to that real quick too. But, you know, police department responds to a 911 call from a room when the building was empty prior to being converted to the Gatton Academy. They get there, they said there's nobody there, the room's empty. While they're standing there, they get a 911 call from another room a couple doors down. They go, there's nobody there. They pick up the phone and call, hey, are we in the right location? Yeah, that's it, that's where the call's coming from. At one point, they are actually in a room, and the dispatch says, hey, we're getting a 911 call from this room. Like, we're in that room. There's nobody here. So they left, and as soon as they arrived, they got outside the door, the sergeant said, come back in with me a second, to the other officer, and said, I want to check something out. And the first room they went to, where the call that originally came from, it didn't even have a phone. So you might could say, well, that's the phone lines or something. But wasn't the only thing that's happened there. Some people from EH&S were over there one time, again, while it was under construction, checking on some things, and they had those big barrel fans to improve circulation in a certain area, and they were in there, and all of a sudden the first fan goes off, then the second fan goes off, then the third fan goes off. I'm like, why is that? If it was a breaker, they would all go off, they check the breaker, everything was fine. They go to check on something else, the light above them goes out, and the gentleman I was talking to, he said, at that point he looked around, his colleague was gone. He's like, so I go back, he said, I decided to leave too. So those are just a few of the stories. And but again, the things that we think we know, nothing happened in that building, but there are still unexplainable events. Are y'all familiar with the history of Vinegar Hill? I know Dr. Bellis, he's heard me speak on this, but Vinegar Hill was the original name for our hill. It's actually had several names, but Vinegar Hill was the most prominent. Charles Jones, who founded Jonesville, actually talked about the hill itself being haunted in the 1800s. There was a lot of, it was a bad part of town, and there were a lot of things that went on there were murders, there were suicides, and there were things like that that went on. And so in paranormal stories, we talk about maybe it's not the building, but it could be the land itself. So, you know, what could have happened? Because, you know, an 18-year-old died in Van Meter or was fatally injured there, but it's a middle-aged man or an older gentleman they see. Potter Hall, they claim that, you know, the young lady who died in 79, but I've interviewed several alumni who said, no, that building was haunted before 1979. They would hear a piano playing in the lobby at night. And if you look at original photos, you'll see a piano in the corner. So bringing it, and one of the reasons I'm passionate about this, and the dean left on Potter, bringing in sociology, I have to bring in sociology. There was a gentleman, Bergman, who's got a theory focusing on local narratives. So these are our stories, and you can't tell a ghost story without learning more about the place, without learning more about the organization and the history. And you're sharing these stories with other people and bringing them together because of those stories. So it's important to do that. I mean, you know, there was a lot of history, if you think back to what I just talked about, a lot of history interwoven in those stories, and it has to be that way. So that's why I find it exciting. And I think, well, I could talk for a long time. I'll sum it up best, again, not about whether you believe in ghosts or not, but there's an excellent quote from a former hall director of Barnes Campbell, and he said, he was quoting the Herald one year, he said, I don't believe in ghosts, but having lived in that building, I believe in unexplainable events. So if you're interested, I can talk all day on this stuff, but anyway, thank you for having me and letting me share a little bit of the ghost stories as we gear up for our Nightmare on Normal Street, and hopefully there will not be any nightmares. I know anybody wants to talk about Craig Administrative Center without the president, I'll be glad to talk. Any questions?
Tamela, you want to talk about the book you're working on. So one of the things that we discussed several months ago is potential quote for the book jacket, but it's a compilation of all of these stories in one place that you've been working on for a couple of years now.
4 years.
4 years. And plus COVID. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, plus COVID. Well, I can still do it because I interviewed by phone, and so COVID didn't slow me down. But yeah, 4 years, like I said, I've interviewed about 80 people, and several have multiple stories because they're housing in residence life who will live in residence halls and have histories. I've got stories from 2020. 2021, 2022. Barnes Campbell did not go out without some last minute things going on before it went down. So,
Tamela, I appreciate the stories. We're not going to put you on the recruitment team for the university.
We're not ready to change our motto to the spirits.
Now, all universities have ghost stories. I will say we have more, but it's our oral history that I'm trying to capture and document. So.
Thank you, Tam. Well, it's great to have you in this room again.
Thank you. Good to see you.
We do have one other item, which President Bononi has requested.
I move that the board go into closed session as provided in KRS 61.810. One for the purpose of discussing proposed or pending litigation against or on behalf of any person.
We will clear the room. Any time.
Okay.
The board has now returned to open session. The discussions and deliberations during the closed session were restricted to those stated in the motion, and no formal action was taken in closed session. I don't think we need a motion to adjourn for committee meetings.
That's correct.
Any comments? Stand adjourned.